superfields and vector superfields. And chiral superfields have a Val fermion, a complex scalar, and an auxiliary F term. Vector superfields have a Val fermion, a vector field, and an auxiliary so-called D term, which is a real scalar. The numbers of degrees of freedom match up. And we have our set of interaction terms. It looks something like this. And oh, and actually, let me also write down the fermion piece. And what we do with this is recall that we take these auxiliary fields and we integrate them out. So we just replace them by their equations of motion. So we take the equation of motion from the Lagrangian, solve for it, and plug back in. And when we do that, what we get, this piece turns into a dw d phi squared piece. This d term combines with the other d term to give a g squared over 2 phi star ta phi squared. And then we still have the same 2g phi dagger ta psi lambda a, and we still have the fermion u power piece. And then add Hermitian conjugates to all the parts that aren't explicitly real. So this piece, these two pieces, make up the scalar potential. All the other terms have fermions. And we can write this as Vf plus Vd. And this first piece, they're both obviously positive semi-definite, and they're both necessarily positive. And I can think of this piece as essentially F squared after matching with the equation of motion. And I can think of this piece as 1/2 dA squared. So this is for a given set of chiral superfield and vector superfield. This is the most general set of interaction terms that are consistent with supersymmetry. And they have to have this specific format so that when I start transforming the scalars into fermions and fermions into scalars according to supersymmetry, this structure remains invariant. If I just wrote down arbitrary scalar terms or fermion terms, I wouldn't have the invariance under transforming one into the other. So one other comment. I've used a bit of a shorthand. So formally, our superpotential depends on the superfield phi. And what I really mean by d2w d phi squared is actually take d2w d phi on the superfield, because it's a function of the superfield, and then you evaluate it at phi on its scalar component. But this is just a handy shorthand. So equivalently, you can think of this as saying that whenever I have a superfield phi in here, in this expression, just replace it by the scalar field and take derivatives with respect to the scalar. And this is the case for a single chiral superfield and a single vector superfield. If I had many different vector superfields and many different chiral superfields, this would generalize. So it generalizes in a way that I think I give you the generalization in your first homework. But roughly, this piece turns into a sum on I dw d phi I squared. So I get one contribution for that from every piece. The d term turns into a g squared over 2, a sum over all the independent representations. So I should say a sum over all the different superfields. So I'll label all the different superfields by I. And and here you sum them all up and then square the whole thing. And this piece, you have one for every you have a contribution to this from every chiral superfield, so I could put a little I on here. And as far as this piece goes, this piece turns into a sum over all ij, 1 half d2w del phi I del phi j psi I psi j. And we saw an explicit example of this when we did SUSY QED. So for example, in SUSY QED, we had two chiral superfields. We had the E and EC. And for SUSY QED, the generators, because it's an abelian group, just turn into the charges. And we saw that our in SUSY QED, our D-term potential, for example, our D-term potential turned out to be d squared over 2 e tilde squared e tilde c squared. So remember that this field had charge minus 1, this field had charge plus 1. So that just generalizes this thing to the abelian case. And we also had the F-term potential. The F-term potential in this case was trivial. It was just m squared e tilde squared plus e tilde c squared. And then we also had the fermion mass term, which just turned out to be m e ec. So again, this SUSY QED structure fits in nicely with this generalization. So in any case, this is how you get non-trivial interactions consistent with supersymmetry. There's a fairly straightforward recipe for it. And what we're going to do with this is use this chiral superfield and vector superfield structure and use it to take the standard model and embed it within the supersymmetric theory. So when we do that, I mentioned this before, we're going to take all the standard model fermions and put them into chiral superfields. We're also going to take the Higgs boson and put it into a chiral superfield. It turns out we're going to need two. And all of the vector bosons of the standard model, the SU3, SU2, and U1, are going to be fit into vector multiplets. And an implication of this is that on top of the standard model states that will correspond to the psi component of chiral superfields for the standard model fermions, or the phi components for the Higgs, or the vector boson components for the standard model vector bosons, will also have these extra states. So extra fermions or extra scalars or what have you. And one thing we're going to have to worry about right off the bat is that if we have exact supersymmetry, in the limit of exact supersymmetry, all the components within a given supermultiplet have to have the same mass. So you can show this on general grounds, and we saw it in an explicit example. We saw it in the Wessel-Mino model. And you can also see it here. The masses of these complex scalars are given by M. And the mass of the Dirac fermion you get by combining these two Weyl fermions is also M. And this is actually a general feature of representations of supersymmetry. And it corresponds to the fact that the p squared operator, which if you like is a mass eigenvalue, commutes with all the generators of supersymmetry and everything else. So this is going to be a problem for the standard model or the standard model extension to supersymmetry, because we obviously know that there's no scalar electron with the same mass as the electron or so on and so forth. So what we're going to have to do is take the supersymmetric structure and break it in a way. So the breaking is a little bit delicate, but that's what I want to get to next. So if you recall, the big part of the motivation for supersymmetry is that it gave you a cancellation between different particles in the supermultiplet, such that the corrections to the Higgs mass could be small. And these corrections to the Higgs mass are guaranteed to be small with exact supersymmetry. But we know that supersymmetry can't be exact if we're going to extend the standard model to include it. So we have to break supersymmetry, but we want to break supersymmetry in a way that doesn't mess up the stabilization mechanism. And the way we add this to the standard model extension to supersymmetry is with something called soft supersymmetry breaking. So the supersymmetry breaking isn't so okay. That's expected. The soft part is a key thing here. And what soft means, and I'll get to this in a second, is we're going to take our supersymmetric Lagrangian, and we're going to add terms to the supersymmetric Lagrangian that explicitly break supersymmetry. So terms that don't fit into this structure. And the soft part is going to be that for every operator that we put in the break supersymmetry, we're going to demand that it comes in with some coupling with positive mass dimension. And the idea here is that this mass dimension coupling, we're going to assume that all the positive mass dimensions are about the same size, of some size that we're going to call M soft. And the idea here is that since the only terms that break the symmetry come in with some positive mass dimension quantity, if we take the theory and we extrapolate it to very high energies, these positive mass dimension pieces will end up being subleading corrections to the rest of the structure. So asymptotically, the theory will be supersymmetric. But at low energies, at or below M soft, the theory won't look supersymmetric at all. And just to give you an aside, for example, of this kind of soft thing, let's go back to our theory of a real scalar. And we had the interaction terms. So two of the interaction terms we considered were a phi cubed plus lambda over 4 factorial phi to the fourth. And one of the things we did when we were talking about dimensional analysis is we estimated the contributions of this operator and this operator to the scattering of phi phi goes to phi phi. And based on dimensional analysis, or you can just go off and compute it, the contribution to the cross-section from the lambda coupling at high energies goes like lambda squared over s. And the contribution from the A piece, if we take it alone, to scattering at high energies, goes like a to the fourth over s cubed. So the a to the fourth comes about because in the amplitude, to make something that's 2 to 2 with 4 external legs, I need at least 2 A factors. And then I have to square the amplitude to get the cross-section contribution. And the whole thing has to go like, essentially, the whole thing has to have mass dimension minus 2. So the only other scale at high energies is essentially the center of mass energy. So I have to put in enough powers of this to, enough powers of this to get the dimensions right. So recall that this S is roughly the center of mass energy squared. So at high energies, in this case, we see that the scattering is dominated by this piece, whereas this piece has a faster fall off with energy going to high energies. So if I look at the limit of very large S, this piece is going to end up being smaller than this, provided that S is the scale corresponding to S, so root S, is much bigger than A. So in other words, I can write this as A squared over S squared times 1 over S. So what we see in this very simple example that I'm just giving to you as an aside is that if I go to very high energies, the dimensionless couplings in my interaction Lagrangian are going to beat out the ones with positive mass dimension. So asymptotically, this piece becomes less and less important and more dominated by this. So the same idea applies for soft supersymmetry breaking. All the pieces we're going to write down that break supersymmetry come in with a positive mass dimension. And the positive mass dimension means that if I go to very high energies, much larger than M soft, these corrections will be subleading compared to the main ones. And the theory will become more and more supersymmetric. So, yes.
So we don't expect this, this to be ruined by a new corrections tool.
Sorry?
We don't expect, this picture to be sort of dramatically changed by loop corrections?
Not especially. The other thing, though, is if you think about loops, having a positive mass dimension also reduces the size of the divergence you can have. So, for example, a correction to A has to have a factor of A in it. And because of that, it can only be log divergent. So it ends up being less divergent than it would be otherwise. So just generally, both at loop level and tree level. So yeah, here I just showed you tree level, but also loop level becomes less and less important. And even more, the effect of these dimensionful positive mass dimension things in loops, the more positive mass dimensions you have in the numerator means the more powers of momentum you have to have in the denominator. So they're also, in a sense, less divergent. Okay, so I'm just going to write down the set of soft terms for a given chiral superfield and vector superfield. And it turns out that the set of soft terms that are going to be relevant to us are the following form. And this is it. So this piece is obviously an extra mass term for the complex for the complex scalar component of the chiral superfield. And these pieces are usually called, people usually talk about them as A, B, or C terms. And they will also, they'll give you new interactions, and they can also correct masses. And in terms of this singlet piece, it can also give you a net VEV, net vacuum expectation value. And this is a Gaetano soft mass. So all these terms, all these terms come in with positive mass dimensions. You just do this by power counting. There's no quartic term because the quartic term would have a dimensionless coupling. And at this level, these terms I've written down explicitly break supersymmetry. And all I mean by explicit is that we start off with a Lagrangian that has some symmetry. And we now add terms to that Lagrangian that don't respect the symmetry. But the way to think about this is that my Lagrangian can be extrapolated up to very high energies that in principle can be much larger than these soft terms. And at energies much larger than the soft terms, these soft terms become less and less important. My theory becomes more and more apparently supersymmetric. So let me also say that we're going to assume that all of these dimensional things that all these dimensional couplings are on the order of this M soft scale. So we're going to characterize all these positive mass dimension couplings by some similar M soft scale. And I'll come back later on and talk about some theories some models for how these soft terms can arise. So the way I'm writing them, in terms of the effect of Lagrangian, they just look like explicit supersymmetry breaking. But ultimately, we expect these kinds of terms to come from some spontaneous supersymmetry breaking, possibly some very high scale. But in the low energy effective theory, they end up looking like explicit breaking. So, well, we'll come back to that in a second as well. So we have our supersymmetric part. We have our supersymmetry breaking part. One last thing I'd like to mention is that with soft supersymmetry breaking, the whole reason for the soft breaking is that the size of the effect is bounded. In that, let's go back to our toy model with let's say I have some set of states, some boson and some fermion psi and psi. They couple to the Higgs. And let's assume that these states both have some large supersymmetric mass, m psi. And let's think about the size of the correction to the Higgs effective mass parameter from integrating out these heavy states. So this is the usual thing we do. So what we had before is that our delta mu squared, assuming that, the delta mu squared, assuming that you have the same coupling strength, went something like y psi squared over 4 pi squared m psi squared over m psi tilde squared. So again, this is just a schematic relation, but it's roughly what you get when you actually compute all the loops. And I think you do an example of this at some point in either the homework or one of the tutorials. The upshot of this, though, is that if I take this within a supersymmetric theory, and these states are coming from the same supermultiplet, supersymmetry forces the same coupling on you, the same dimensionless coupling on you, but it also forces these two masses to be equal. So you get a cancellation, and the threshold correction, at least the big threshold correction, the delta mu squared vanishes. But now if you put in supersymmetry breaking, what we're going to get is, let's say this is a scalar and this is a fermion. What we're going to get with soft Susy breaking is that we're still going to have a universal y psi. So we're assuming that this is some dimensionless coupling that comes in, and supersymmetry preserves that. And this is also preserved with soft supersymmetry breaking because you don't change the dimensionless stuff. But what soft breaking is going to do is it's going to split the scalar mass for the fermion mass. And generically, the splitting goes like m soft squared. Now, if I take this relation and I plug it back in here, this thing, in a softly broken supersymmetric theory, is going to go like y psi squared over 4 pi squared m soft squared. So instead of my initial worry, where I'd have a large factor of this big mass, let's assume that the big mass is much, much bigger than m soft. What I get instead is a cancellation between the scalar and the fermion contributions to the extent that I've softly broken supersymmetry. And now instead of giving the big mass, m squared, I get the soft mass squared here. And if we think about applying this to the standard model Higgs and supersymmetric extension, I can have various corrections to it. But one thing this tells me is that if I assume that y psi is of order 1, this means that m soft shouldn't be too big. So this means that m soft should be less than roughly the value of mu squared I want to get over the value of mu squared I want to get times 4 pi squared, or because we know the value of mu for the Higgs is about 100 GeV, this means that RM soft should be less than about 4 times 100 GeV, which is roughly the less than about 1,000 GeV or so. So when we apply this to the MSSM, when we go to supersymmetrize the standard model, we're going to put in soft breaking terms for the superpartners for all the standard model fields. But because of this general argument, again, I've just given it to you schematically, but you can go and sit down and compute an explicit example and see that it comes out this way, is that to keep these corrections to the Higgs mass parameter acceptably small, I want to have my superpartners to be relatively light. By relatively light, they shouldn't be too much heavier than about a TeV or so. And this is exciting because this is the energy range that the LHC is probing.
Why do you assume the coupling is an order of one?
The coupling? That's a worst case scenario. And what we're going to see when you supersymmetrize the standard model is that there will be corrections to the Higgs mass parameter from the superpartners. And one of the superpartners will be the superpartner of the top quark. And we know that has an order one coupling to the Higgs. So in that case, we'll see explicitly that for that standard model superpartner, the top quark superpartner, it's going to have a correction on the order of this size. And that thing is going to have to be lighter than about 1,000 GeV. But actually, you make a good point, because you can also think about applying this argument to the superpartners of, let's say, the up and down quarks. And we know the up and down quarks, because our masses are so small, only couple really, really weakly to the standard model Higgs. And it turns out that for those superpartners, if we're only worried about their contributions to the Higgs mass parameter, they can actually be much, much heavier. Because instead of just having a mu squared times 4 pi squared, I also have a y psi squared. So you're right. So if I have a very small y psi squared, that should be y psi, I can, in principle, push up the mass of that corresponding superpartner. The generic expectation is all superpartners are usually relatively close in mass, but there are some exceptions to that. So I'll come back to this later. But at least for now, assuming you have an order one coupling, you want to have order one TeV superpartners.
So this is sort of like the best case scenario in terms of searching.
Yeah, but this is also going to apply to the superpartners of the top quarks, because those necessarily have an order one coupling. It won't necessarily apply to other so-called light fermion superpartners, because, for example, an electron has a Yukawa coupling less than 10 to the minus 3. So as far as that goes, the electron superpartner could actually be very heavy.
So you
usually don't see this for two reasons. The first is that to write this in a Lagrangian, your phi field has to be totally uncharged under everything. So if it has any gauge charge or anything or global charge, it's forbidden. I'm just writing it down because in principle, if you have a singlet in your theory, you could write it down. The other thing is I could actually get rid of it in the sense that to write it down, phi has to be a total singlet. And if you have a state that's a total singlet, there's no special point in the potential in the sense of having a zero value or non-zero value for the field doesn't break any kind of symmetry. And what you could do in that case is you could actually get rid of the tadpole piece, this T piece, by shifting phi. And shifting phi would also change the coefficients of the other terms. And you could always rewrite your theory such that phi is minimized at the origin at the expense of shifting the other terms by the same amount.
So I
wrote down the most general thing, but I could actually, without any loss of generality, actually get rid of the tadpole thing. It's just that in some cases, thinking about an explicit tadpole can be useful. So it's just a matter of convention. OK, so the next thing I want to get to is supersymmetrizing the standard model. And I'm going to concentrate, for the most part, on the minimal supersymmetrization. And it's called the minimal supersymmetric standard model, or the MSSM. So you'll hear people talk about MSSM a lot because staying minimal supersymmetric standard model is long to say and long to write. And in the MSSM, embedding all the standard model fields is fairly straightforward. Recall that in your standard model course, you wrote down all the standard model fermions in terms of left-handed Weyl fermions, so in terms of left-hand spinners. And the set of things you write down in terms of left-handed spinners is this. So under the standard model gauge groups, this is a 3, 2, hypercharge 1/6. This is a 3 bar 1 minus 2/3. This is a 3 bar 1 1/3. This is a 1, 2, minus 1/2. And this is a 1, 1, plus 1. So this DC is the left-handed spinner whose conjugate is the right-handed down quark. So the idea is that is I take this, I conjugate it to get the right-handed down quark, and we know that the right-handed down quark is a 3 with hypercharge minus 1/3, and that means that because we take this thing and get something with hypercharge minus 1/3 that's a 3, this is the conjugate of the right-handed down, so it's a 3 bar with 1/3. Similarly, for the UC, it's a 3 bar with hypercharge minus 2/3. And for the EC, it has hypercharge plus 1. Because again, it's because conjugate it. So for example, UC dagger alpha dot is what we call D right. Sorry, U right. And so on and so forth. So again, I think this was covered in your standard model course, so I won't go over it again. But in any case, it's good that this was covered because the natural embedding of this in supersymmetry involves chiral multiplets. And chiral multiplets are typically formulated in terms of left-handed Weyl fermions. So we take this, and we're now set to embed all these fields into Weyl fermions. So we take these. And for each of these standard model representations, we embed them in a chiral supermultiplet. So for example, I can think of Q as UL DL. And these are going to go into a chiral supermultiplet with a scalar Q tilde, the fermion Q, and an F term F sub Q, where these are now all two component objects in SU2 space. So this Q tilde is going to be U tilde L, D tilde L. And we can do the same thing with UC. And in terms of FUC, because we often, well, at least historically, we talk about right-handed up quarks and right-handed down quarks, this object, the scalar object, it's a complex scalar, is often written as the complex conjugate of a field they call U tilde right. So this is a complex scalar. And because people often like to talk about right-handed up quarks and so on, we match this. We just call this the complex conjugate of the right-handed up. So this is just a matter of notation, but it's a matter of notation to match this two-component language to the, let's say, more historical four-component language or upright, downright language that's often used in the standard model. And then you do the same thing with the rest of these multiplets. And so far, I've only written down one generation, but there are three copies of this structure, one for each generation as well. Again, just like the standard model. So we have the set of chiral supermultiplets. And there is a second contribution, a second thing we put into chiral supermultiplets, and that is the Higgs. So let me get to the Higgs next. So in the standard model, you recall that we have a Higgs, which, depending on your convention, you can write it as 1, 2, minus 1 half. And when you write down the standard model Yukawa couplings, you use the Higgs in this form to generate the down quark Yukawa interactions. And you take a complex conjugate of it, possibly written as H tilde, to give mass to the up quarks. What happens in supersymmetry, though, is that we're going to take this Higgs scalar, and we're going to embed it in a chiral supermultiplet. And we're going to get our Yukawa interactions out of a superpotential. And because we get our Yukawa interactions out of a superpotential, we're not allowed to conjugate any of the fields of the superpotential, because the superpotential has to be holomorphic. The superpotential only depends on chiral superfields, not their conjugates. And that means that the trick to use in the standard model, where you take a single Higgs and you conjugate it to give both up and down Yukawa couplings, doesn't work in supersymmetry. The other thing is that when we put this into a chiral multiplet, we're going to have the complex scalar part, but we're also going to have a charged two-component fermion, a charged vial fermion. And it turns out that if I only put in a single Higgs, my SU2 gauge group and my hypercharged gauge groups would end up being anomalous. So have you seen gauge anomalies? Not at all. OK, so it turns out that OK, this is a quick aside. So you all know about gauge invariance. So gauge invariance, it's not quite a symmetry. It's more of a redundancy in the theory. And one thing you want to make sure is, except for maybe spontaneous breaking, that you're not actually allowed to break a gauge invariance explicitly. Because a gauge invariance is saying that these different parts of these fields I'm using in my theory are actually redundant degrees of freedom, and ultimately I'm going to project them out. So it wouldn't make sense to explicitly break that. You can spontaneously break it, because that's just shuffling around degrees of freedom, but you're not allowed to explicitly break it, because that would ruin this ability to project out degrees of freedom. Explicitly breaking a gauge invariance would say that you have actually more degrees of freedom than you're really there. So that's the first thing. The other thing is that if you look at quantum corrections, there are quantum effects that, in principle, could explicitly break the gauge invariance. And these effects, where it looks like you have a symmetry at the level of the Lagrangian you write down, the classical Lagrangian, the quantum effects come in and possibly break that classical symmetry. In that case, that symmetry is said to be anomalous. So it's not actually a symmetry anymore. Quantum effects break the symmetry, even though it looks like you have your original Lagrangian symmetric under it. So it turns out that this can happen in gauge theories. Quantum effects can come in and explicitly break the gauge invariance. But your whole interpretation of the gauge theory wouldn't make sense in that case. So we want to avoid this. So you have to make sure that these quantum corrections, these quantum breaking effects, all cancel out. And the cancellation of quantum breaking, it turns out, is automatic if your fermions come in left-right pairs, in the sense that if I have a vial fermion with charge plus 1, let's say under a U1, if I also have another vial fermion with charge minus 1, their contributions to this quantum breaking and end up canceling out. So it turns out that if I only had a single Higgs and I supersymmetrized it, I would get a gauge anomaly. This would make the theory inconsistent. So a second reason why I need at least two Higgs doublets is to cancel out these gauge anomalies. So sorry for the quick aside. Maybe I can talk more about anomalies later on. But for now, what we're going to do is, instead of using a single Higgs, we're going to use a pair of Higgs supermultiplets with opposite hypercharges. the supermultiplets that these correspond to are going to have a scalar component. Oops, D. And an F term. So just a quick comment on my notation. I'm using a slight abusive notation where I'm using the same symbol for the name of the chiral supermultiplet and the component of that supermultiplet that corresponds to the standard model state we all know and love. So for example, for UC, I'm using the symbol UC both for the name of the supermultiplet, but also for the fermion component corresponding to the conjugate of the right-handed up quark. I'm doing the same thing for these Higgs multiplets, but now the thing I'm doubling the notation on is the Higgs that correspond to these Higgs fields that correspond to the Higgs as we know and love. So actually, maybe I won't do this in notes, but for the time being, I'm going to put a little hat on the superfields, just to help you keep things straight. I guess I'll go and do that above. But in practice, people tend to not write hats. So the hats mean superfields, just so you don't mix it up. OK. Now, going back to the Higgs stuff, between the QUDLE, the cuddly fields, and our Higgses, H up, H down, these are all the chiral supermultiplets that it takes to embed the standard model in supersymmetry. And the only other thing we need for this part of the theory is a superpotential. And the superpotential of the MSSM has the following terms. It has the Higgs mass parameter, mu hu dot hd. OK, and I'll put hats on stuff for now. It has an uptype quark Yukawa. It has a downtype quark Yukawa. And it has a lepton Yukawa. And that's it. And this should look fairly familiar. This piece is going to, this piece looks just like the standard model Yukawa coupling. But now I have a Higgs up. Here I have a Higgs down for the down type. And the Higgs down also gives a down type here. This Higgs down, in terms of its doublet structure, has the form H0 down, H minus down. If I split it into an SU2 doublet and put on the effect of electric charges after electric symmetry breaking, and this thing I could split into H plus U, H0 U. So the top piece of the doublet for Higgs down has zero charge, and the bottom part has zero charge here. And this thing are what will get vacuum expectation values to break electroweak symmetry. Now, I've done a few other things here. This dot means something. This dot means that I take the SU2 indices and I can track them with the epsilon tensor. So what this stands for is here HU is an SU2 doublet, and so is HD. So suppose I write down the SU2 structure with an A. Like so. So this contraction between a pair of SU2 doublets, I'm taking their SU2 indices and I'm contracting them with the epsilon tensor. And you can show that this epsilon contraction is invariant. You can show that this epsilon contraction is invariant under SU2 transformations. So in other words, I can think of this as HU plus, if I was to expand this out in terms of the components, it would look like this. Yes?
So these are the all the terms that are allowed under supersymmetry and gauge invariance?
There are some more, but I'll get to that. So these are the terms we write down as the MSSM superpotential. It turns out there are a few more terms I could have written down, but I'll come back to that. But in any case, this dot means that I'm contracting up the SU2 indices with this epsilon tensor. And with a bit of fiddling, you can show that contracting SU2 indices with an epsilon tensor gives you a singlet. If you think back to spin, for example, the procedure of adding spin, recall if you had two spin 1/2s, those are two twos under SU2, and the antisymmetric combination corresponded to the spin 0 combination. So that antisymmetric combination corresponding to spin 0, being the invariant piece, is exactly what you're doing here. Here, I also have, I'm also contracting the SU2 indices between this guy and this guy with the epsilon in the same way as before. But I also have SU3 indices. But these SU3 indices contract up automatically in that this is a 3 bar and this is a 3. So those contract up to give a singlet automatically. And I'm doing the same thing here with a 3 and 3 bar, the same epsilon contraction on the SU2 indices. And again, SU2 and X contraction here. And you can check that hypercharge works out for everything. Here I have plus 1/2, minus 1/2, that's 0. Here I have 1/6, plus 1/2, minus 2/3, 0. 1/6, minus 1/2, plus 1/3, and so on and so forth. So everything is gauge invariant. And I see that these have the structure, these have the usual structure of the standard model Yukawa couplings. And if I think about the Lagrangian interactions I would derive from the superpotential, with a bit of thinking, you can show that you will get back the standard model Yukawa couplings. So for example, recall that I have terms that look like 1/2 dTw d phi I d phi j psi I psi j. So if I take terms like this, and I differentiate with respect to two standard model fermion components here. So if I was to take this piece and differentiate with respect to this guy and this guy, what I would be left over with in the scalar part of the superpotential would just be the scalar Higgs U. And then I'd put back in the two fermion pieces, Q and UC. So this part of the superpotential interaction that I derive from this would reproduce the standard up-type Yukawa couplings. But I'd also get other things. I'd also get a corresponding connection between, for example, the fermion component of this, the scalar component of this, and the fermion component of that, and so on and so forth. So this Lagrangian reproduces all the Yukawa couplings of the standard model, but it also gives me new interactions between these superpartners, the scalar and fermion superpartners. So just a comment on terminology. So here I have here my standard model fermions are given as above. For all the standard model fermions, we call the superpartners fermions. So I just stick an S in front. For the Higgs, the standard model Higgs scalars have fermionic superpartners. And we call these Higgsinos. So if I start mumbling about fermions or Higgsinos, that's what I'm talking about. So this is my superpotential. The other thing I need are gauge multiplets. So let me step up. The other thing I need are gauge multiplets. And the gauge multiplets are straightforward. I have my U1 B mu field. And this goes into a B hat supermultiplet that has a fermion piece, the same vector field and a D term. The W mu piece goes into a vector superfield. And my SV3 part this way. That has this form. So again, as far as the vector part of the theory goes, I just embed all of my standard model vector bosons within vector supermultiplets. The terminology here is that for every standard model gauge boson, the superpartner is called a gaugino. And gauge invariance plus the gauge charges I started with up here completely fix all of the interactions between these vector multiplets and the standard model superfields, the standard model matter superfields. So there, it's just a matter of you covariantize all of the covariant derivatives or all the regular derivatives, and then you put in the extra terms you need for supersymmetry, these root 2g, phi star, ta, psi, lambda. And the new terms I have here are these new gauginos. OK, so this is the full supersymmetric part of the MSSM. And slide this back piece. This is the full supersymmetric part of the MSSM. And there are two more aspects I want to mention. So one aspect, and I'll get to this in a second, are the set of soft breaking terms. So we know that we need the soft breaking to push up fermion masses relative to gauge boson masses. To push up the superpartner masses relative to the standard model masses. But one other comment I want to make goes back to the superpotential. And with a bit of fiddling, you can show that the superpotential I wrote down isn't actually the most general one that's consistent with supersymmetry or gauge invariance. So I'm going to write down a set of extra superpotential terms I could have included in the MSSM superpotential, but that I didn't. And I'll explain my notation in a second. So I won't bother writing down. I won't bother writing down couplings, but these are terms I could have written, operators I could have written down in the superpotential, but I did not include. And there's a reason for this. And the reason for this is that they all break either baryon or lepton number. So this thing has a net lepton number of -1. This thing has a net baryon number of -1. This thing violates lepton number because I have one lepton. And again, this violates lepton number. And we know that experimentally, baryon and lepton number are really good symmetries. So we don't see lepton flavor conversion, so we don't see muons spontaneously turned into electrons, and we also don't see things like proton decay. And if we just wrote down all these operators in the MSSM Lagrangian or the MSSM superpotential with kind of order one couplings, we'd find really bad stuff, like your proton would decay really quickly, or it'd have muons transferring into electrons all the time, and this is stuff we just don't see. So these are terms that we could have written down, but we don't want them. And there's a clever way to get rid of them. And the clever way to get rid of them is something called R parity. So the R slash here means that all these terms are going to violate this R parity symmetry. So R parity is R parity is going to be a parity symmetry, so a Z2, under which the different components of these different supermultiplets are going to have slightly different charges. So as far as R parity goes, we define the R parity of a supermultiplet to be the R parity of its lowest component. So and that charge is going to be plus or minus one because it's just a parity symmetry. So things are just odd or even. And for anything else in a supermultiplet, the R charge of other stuff in the supermultiplet is going to be the R charge of the lowest component times minus 1 times 2 S minus S naught. So this is the spin of that particular component. And S naught is the spin of the lowest component of the multiplet. So instead of talking about it this way, it's easier just to show it explicitly. So Q, UC, DC, L have R parity of minus 1. Have R parity of plus 1. And all the vector multiplets, V, 1, 2, 3, have R parity minus 1. So what this means is that the fermions in general are odd, and the center model fermions are even. So when I say that these supermultiplets are odd, that means that the lowest component is odd, and that means that the scalar is odd. But if I look at the fermion relative to the scalar has spin 1/2. The zero component has spin 0. So I get an extra factor of minus 1 relative to the lowest component. And that means that the fermions are even. As far as the Higgses go, this means that HUD, the Higgs scalars, are even. But the next component up, the Higgsinos, are odd. And then as far as these vector multiplets, remember the lowest component is the Gaugino. And the gauge boson so this is a, let's say, slightly more formal definition, but a quick mnemonic to remember how it goes is that all the standard model parts of the MSSM are even under R parity, and all of the and all their superpartners are odd. So this kind of feels right in that superpartners are kind of weird and regular stuff is not so weird. Now, if I apply this R parity to these terms, relative to those terms, it's easy to see that all the terms up there are even under R parity. Because, for example, let's say I look at the Higgs up, Higgs down. That's trivially even, because the Higgs up and Higgs down are both even. For the Yukawa terms, the two fermion parts, let's say Q hat and U hat, are odd, but H is even. So those terms are all even, it's easy to see. Now, it's also easy to see that all these terms are odd. So this is odd even, that's odd, 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 odd. So if I take my MSSM to be the most general set of interactions consistent with supersymmetry, plus gauge invariance, plus R parity, I get back the MSSM superpotential. If I relax R parity, I start to get these new operators that are a problem. So I'm going to concentrate almost exclusively on the MSSM defined with R parity, which is that. But there's a body of interesting work where people look at breaking R parity. And it turns out that you can get away with this if you only have some set of these terms and if their effective couplings are very small. Now, in the case of R parity, and I'll wrap up in a second, R parity has two important implications. So R implications. The first is that the superpartners are all odd under R parity, and my theory conserves R parity. And the first implication is that superpartners must be created in Paris. In the sense that if I'm colliding two standard model particles, the standard model particles are R even, and the final state also has to be R even. So the final state has superpartners, it has to have an even number of superpartners. So this will be important for LHC searches. The second implication is that the lightest superpartner, often called the LSP, is stable. And again, this is a trivial result of the parity. If I take the lightest odd object, the only things that are lighter than it are assumed to be even, and that means it just doesn't have any decay modes. So the two implications of our parity that are really important for collider searches and also other searches are that I have to make my superpartners in pairs. This makes our life the LHC a little bit more difficult. But at the same time, the lightest superpartner is stable. And having a lightest superpartner being stable is kind of nice because this tells me that I have a new massive state that's stable. And this kind of new massive state being stable is just the thing that I want for dark matter, as long as this new state is also electrically neutral and uncharged under SU3 color. So the stable LSP is also a nice offshoot of R parity. So R parity is motivated by getting rid of these problems, but it has a nice corollary that you get a nice dark matter candidate. So I'll come back to that a little bit tomorrow.